Mr. Henderson, Reel 11. The training that you were getting at Wickham Market and the area around it, was it appropriate, looking back, was it appropriate to what and helpful when you got into the fighting situation?
Oh, my word, yes. We didn't know what we were going to do. Nobody told us where we were going or anything. But we had an idea that we were going to be in the second front, as it was called then. But we didn't know where at or what we were going to do or what our role would be. But certainly, what the training that we did, we trained with the infantry, as I've said. Our infantry was the 3rd Infantry Division, and we trained with those. We also went to a lake, Fritton Lake, where all the vehicles went through there to be they were waterproofed to show that how you could go through to a soft vehicle. A driver could drive through with the water chest high in bottom gear against the force of water and still run through. He had no brakes when he came out of the other end, but water couldn't get to his engine. It was all sealed off with a kind of plasticine. This was the sort of training we were doing. Waterproofing was one of the things. A lot of radio training, intergroup training. Yes, it was very much into what we were going to be. It was all part of the preparation. And by about September, new people were coming. New young 20-year-old, 19 and 20-year-olds were coming from the training regiment. And it was a very, very young regiment by this time. The old ones were going away. I don't mean the old men, but the older ones that had been in Dunkirk and in India. They were all being sent back to training regiments to be batmen or trainers to train the younger ones. And we were a young regiment, and by about September we were ready. We were more or less up to what we should be. And then we started to do various different training. The A and B squadrons went down to Portsmouth sometime in September to do the DD training. C squadron, before that they went over to Castle Martin. All the gunners went to Castle Martin, just the gunners, to shoot on the tank ranges at Castle Martin in South Wales, Pembroke. And then C squadron and went up to Ecclefechan, near Lockerbie, just the other side of Carlisle. They weren't going to be DDs. They went up to Scotland, C squadron, HQ squadron. The smaller vehicles all went up to Scotland, to Ecclefechan. A and B squadron went down to Gosport to do training in the Channel. After Christmas, after the New Year, the beginning of January, A and B squadron, I was one of them, went back to Ecclefechan, where I immediately went on leave. That, as it turned out, was embarkation leave. That was the last leave that any of us got before we went over to France. I came back to Ecclefechan, and I think the next day we all moved up to Fort George, the other side of Inverness. And there, the tanks up there, the DD tanks up there, were Valentines. A and B squadron were training on the Valentines in the Moray Firth, and C squadron were busy doing, and RHQ waterproofing all their Shermans. This went on until about March, when we moved again.
You've said that you were doing this water training.
Waterproofing.
Were there any accidents in this training?
Yes, there was. There was a chap killed. One chap was drowned. Something happened with the tank. I don't know what was happened. It was A squadron. I think it was an A squadron. It could have been a B. I was told that, and we knew one of the that about this chap that had been drowned when the tank sunk. It slipped off the landing craft or something and overturned on the ramp, something of that kind, and the officer slipped off and went down in the very, very cold water, and he nearly froze to death. But the driver was drowned. That was the only, I think that was the only accident that we had.
It might be appropriate this time, since we're talking about the use of tanks in water, on water, to explain what a DD tank was.
Well, a DD tank is a... The DD stands for duplex drive. It has been called Donald Duck's, but however, duplex drive is the official name. It was two propellers that operated on a hinge. When you pulled them down on a hinge basis, when you were on the road, they were hinged up. When you wanted to go in the water, you hinged them down, and then the power takeoff on your gear lever engaged those two propellers, and as soon as your track started to move, the propellers started to move also. So your tracks moved in conjunction with your twin propellers, and they'd propel they propelled the tank through the water. There was no steering. You pointed the tank to the beach, and that was it. You could flounder about, but there was no steering as such. The only way you could try to steer was to slow one of your tracks, because your tracks did act as a little bit of a paddle, but not steering as such. There was no rudders up or anything like that.
And this is all done from the driver?
This is all done from the driver, yes. Yeah.
To get the hinge to go down whilst you're in the tack, did you have some kind of a lever to pull?
No, you pulled them down.
Before you got in?
Yes. It was engaged, yes. Before you came off the landing craft.
Had your Shermans been adapted for this at this stage?
No, our Shermans hadn't been adapted. This is what we've just been thinking about. It's a long time, 50 years, over 50 years. It's a long time to remember. And we didn't think of where these details at that particular time. Until I've started doing this interview and wondered what happened to our Shermans from Wicker Market. They weren't adapted for DDs. So, consequently, they weren't the tanks that we had. The tanks that we had at Inverness weren't the ones we went into action with. They were Valentines. And after, when we were due to leave Fort George, those Valentines were taken with canvas covers on, because they were very, very secret. They were very, very on the secret list. They were taken down to North Wales with covered up on tank transporters, and the ATS girls, we stayed there 5 days with them, while the ATS girls took the skirts off them, which was the things that held you up when they were inflated, and dismantled them, and we left them there.
So you've got your two propellers as part of the drive, and then you've got this apron that you're talking
this
about.
This big apron, and it was held up by inner tubes with a cane support, like a concertina. It went up like a concertina was going up. And when you inflated they were like a big straight rubber inner tube, and it was shaped like a boat at the front. It was shaped with these cane ribs. And when you inflated the rubber inner tube type things, it carried the skirt up, and that was it.
How was the inflation done? How were you able to inflate?
Compressed air bottles. And then when you hit the beach, your gun had to be down facing to the back, because it wouldn't... The skirt wouldn't have gone up if the paddle had been facing forward. So as soon as you hit the beach, you dropped your skirts, and then swiveled your gun round, and you were ready for action. And at your leisure time, you chopped off the skirts, which was as soon as you had a break in action.
So,
but you could still fight with the skirts on.
Driving towards the beach with skirts up, You would be blind. Where were the you in relation to the surface of the water?
The driver was completely blind. He was... we were told that only last year that the driver was 11 feet below the waterline. The crew were standing on top of the turret. The crew weren't inside the tank at all. In case of mishap, the crew had life jackets on, and the driver had a Davis escape apparatus with a clip on his nose and a rubber thing in his mouth, and gym slippers, gym shoes on, in case which three did sink on the run in. 34 left the landing craft, and 31 hit the beach, which was a fantastic number. With that kind of, we'd never trained in that kind of weather. 6 feet the waves were, you know, it was dreadful.
What was your reaction when you were first told in training, this is a tank that will go through water, you're going to drive it?
I don't think we believed it, that a tank would float. And at first it was a bit of a non-starter because they only had one propeller on. The originals only had one propeller, and they floundered about all over the place. They hadn't enough speed to head for the in a straight line. They wouldn't go in a straight line, so that was off, and they were given two propellers, and that was a different arrangement altogether. Then it was a success, but. It was barely a success. We were very fortunate, I think, to do what we did with them. We were the only regiment that used them. The 4th-7 had lost a lot of theirs in training. The sudden squall in the channel had sank some of their landing craft with the tanks on, and they hadn't time to replace them. The Americans had some episodes say that the Americans used them, but only three got ashore. Some say that they never used them, and we don't know what the true story. These were the American Rangers on Omaha Beach. I don't think any, well, none, certainly none hit the beach, I don't think, except ours. And Jerry must have got an awful shock when these little boats came out of the sea and suddenly turned into Sherman tanks. But they were a huge success. And he was saying about what was the role of a tank? Well, of course, on the beach, there was shelter to the infantry. The machine gun was just below the driver. The machine gun came out of the tank just below where the driver was sitting, the second driver was sitting, and he could operate that. And to have infantrymen facing a machine gun with no shelter was just suicide. It was pointed out in the showing on the Somme. But if you could go forward, sheltering behind the Sherman tanks, who had a machine gun on themselves, it was a different kettle of fish altogether. And this is what happened.
Well, your Valentines that you got when you went up to Scotland were the very first training DD tanks that you used.
Yes.
And you say you brought those down to Wales.
They were taken to Wales and left there. So we don't know what happened to those Valentines after that.
So what happened to you then up in Scotland or wherever you
were? We came from Fort George, then we came down by road to Petworth in Sussex.
What date would this be?
That would be about March. And in Petworth there were Petworth House was a stately home, and we were in the grounds in wooden huts, Nissen huts, and we had tank parks and so forth, and we didn't move out of there. And then we moved from there down to Gosport. I can't remember exactly how long. I've been trying to think. 2 or 3 weeks before the invasion, we went down to Gosport. This really, Fort George was the last time the regiment were together as a regiment until I think after the war, more or less. until we got to Hanover after the war. I think that was the last time. An infantry, a tank regiment doesn't go into action as a regiment, not like an infantry regiment would do. You might get A squadron would go with the Norfolks, and B squadron with the Suffolks, and C squadron with somebody else, and even then you would get first and second troop would go with different platoons or different companies of infantry. So you never really knew what was happening, or what was happening to the rest of the regiment. You were a small group that were more or less on their own.
And you were still with the headquarters at this time?
Yes. And where had we got to? We got down to Petworth. We went to Gosport. Now, at Gosport, we were in an empty house at Gosport. And rather a funny thing happened. Two of the air squadron boys wanted to go and get married. It's just incidentally a little story that might be of interest. And this is just before the invasion. So they applied to go to Skipton to get married. There was nothing. It wasn't a shotgun marriage or anything like that. We didn't do things like that in those days. It was just that they were madly in love and wanted to get married. To me, a silly thing, but nevertheless, the police went to the girlfriend's house and said, "Are you going to marry Mr. Masters?" And she said, "Yes." So the policeman went away and informed the regiment that it was perfectly honest. So I think they got 3 days' leave to come home and get married. He went back a day early, thinking that they were both going to meet at the station. One didn't turn up. So Gil came back to the regiment and thought the other chap had done a runner. However, when he got back, he found that he was to come back a day too early. So what are you doing back? You're not due to tomorrow. But when he got back, he was also in an empty house in Gosport. And when he got to the empty house, it was empty. And all his friends had all gone, and he was in a bit of a panic. So he walked to the police station and he asked where the people were from that house. And the police said, "Oh, they've gone. I don't know where they've got to. I wish I did, because one of them has been involved in an accident and we want to trace him." So anyway, he walked down to the Hards, to the waterside, and there he was met by the Sergeant Major, Scholar Gough, an old infantry an old cavalry man, a riding school instructor and things. "You're back, Masters. Well, get in there, and once you're in there, over this little wooden bridge, and you won't get out anymore." So that you were sealed in again on the Hards, ready for the invasion. And then we got onto the landing craft at Gosport and pulled out into Southampton water.
Was this at the time, as you say, when you were completely sealed in?
Completely sealed in.
Were you guarded inside that area so that you couldn't get out?
Yes, by military police with blue caps on, and barbed wire and all sorts of things. You were in and you couldn't get out. You didn't want to get out. That was it.
At what point did you know or realise that you were going into...
Oh, then, that was it.
That was the beginning of the knowledge.
We knew, I think we knew 3 or 4 weeks before that it was imminent. We knew we were all ready to go. We were ammoed up and everything. The tanks were ready for action. And we didn't know where we were going. We knew we were going to France, we didn't know what part. We just knew that we were ready for the off. And we weren't allowed to speak to anybody about anything. It was very, very hush-hush. Very, very hush-hush. And we couldn't go out. And we
How did they keep your spirits up while you were tied into that?
Oh, I think one little thing. We didn't have any radios or anything. But I did have an old gramophone that I'd got from a girlfriend in Leeds that I'd carried back up to Fort George. And we tied it on the back of the tank, and it eventually got blown up. But we all clubbed up to get a record. In the Mood on one side and Woodchopper's Ball on the other. Roy Fox? And we played it over and over again. We used to read polished things, just anything to keep busy. but there was an awful lot of hanging and waiting about. And we couldn't polish our equipment, but we saw that everything was all right, and the tanks were checked and overchecked and checked again, and to see that nothing had been left out. The waterproofing was checked and checked and checked by the Rimi, and these Rimi groups of Rimi people checked different parts of the thing and put a different colour on, red, blue and yellow, and when you had all three colours painted on, the tank was, anyone knew that was ready for off.
Were you able to write letters and receive
them? You could write letters, but they were all censored, which made it difficult. You didn't really want your officers to know what you were writing about, or you felt it was the first time we'd had censorship, and we didn't take to it very kindly. I was trying to think about money. We didn't have any money, I don't think. Money wasn't. We didn't get any pay parade, because all we could buy was your naffy ration of cigarettes. And at that particular time, we were living more or less on compo rations, that we had cigarettes in there, but we did have a naffy ration. We must have had. I can't remember buying naffy rations there, but we must have had.
Did you receive any mail? Was any mail coming?
Yes, mail came in as normal.
The addresses that you were using when you were fastened in there, you wouldn't be able to use that address if you were writing out.
Oh no, you just used British Army Field Post Office.
Which gave nothing away.
Which gave BFPO, British Field Post Office, it was number 29 or something like that. That was all you had. That was just, and no stamps. You didn't have to put a stamp on your letter, which was rather a novelty.
Did anyone at this stage, around about this stage, talk to you about, well, obviously, what you were going to do, and the possibility of what your losses might be, estimates of that kind? Were you being told this kind of thing?
We weren't told anything about losses. That was left to our own imagination, and we imagined that it was going to be very heavy. But I can't think that any of us were ever put out by this. In fact, the losses weren't bad at all, really. On D-Day, we lost 16 killed, and 19 were wounded, and 83 were missing. Now, of those 83, there was three tanks that sank. They wouldn't all be killed. In fact, one driver got out of the tank when it sank and came up, and his head hit the underside of a landing craft, which was rather a funny story. But that's what one of the drivers did. The others would be floating about on top of the sea with their life jackets on and getting picked up by landing craft. It was just the drivers that were at risk. But that was the total number for that particular day. And really, D-Day wasn't as bad as days which were going to come later when the tanks joined in the action, you know. So that was it. And on D-Day, just as another matter of interest, there was one DSO, four military crosses and 12 military medals issued, and they were given by Montgomery at a later date to the people that owned them. Those military medals and military crosses were for tank commanders. Now, the crews didn't get anything, but the commander got the... That was for the tank, for how the tank had behaved.
The quality of your training for D-Day itself, were you shown ground models and so forth, so you had a good...
No, we didn't. No, we didn't have... We didn't have any sort of thing like that.
The infantry had this...
We had the Black Isle on the Moray Firth, and that was Normandy. It wasn't called Normandy, but that was where we attacked. We ran ashore at the Black Isle, and we came back and we landed ashore again at Fort George, but that was all we had.
So we never shown models of the
of the beach,
photographs and this kind of thing.
I don't suppose they would really have any.
Possibly, of course, the commanders might have done.
They might have done, but I can't remember being shown any of those. It may be that the tank crew commanders might have. Is that what you mean, the commanders? They might have done, but I can't remember ever being shown them. There was something else I was going to say about that. It might crop up later. The food at Gosport, I don't remember what we were living off. I can't remember how we must have been fed by a cook wagon or something. We must have been. I don't think we would cook our own food down there. And what did we do? Oh, I know what it was. The discipline at this particular time, you lived in overalls, and you lounged about, and you rested as much as you could, which we were told to do. Relax and rest, which was all you could do. The discipline that we'd been used to at Wickham Market, where you didn't look the wrong way at anyone once you were put on a charge, that finally, we'd got out of that, and we were soldiers at last. We weren't young rookies, we were men. We got the feeling that we were men at last, that we were trusted to do our duty.
Were men in these final stages on the eve of D-Day, were men, or some men, showing signs of nerves and apprehension?
I don't think I ever saw anyone frightened. If there were, they kept it very much to themselves. I think we were all a bit frightened and a bit scared, but there was a lot of forced laughter, which maybe gave the game away a bit. But there was always somebody there with a joke and a quip, especially the London boys. And the Liverpool lads, they were born comedians, if you know what I mean, and there was always someone there to come out to cheer you up a bit. They were a very, very good team, and a very happy team, and it was a very, very exciting time. You know, it was marvellous, really. And it's just a pity that the boys today haven't got that kind of get-togetherness and spirit of adventure, because that's what it was. It was a big adventure.
Were you told, in the last analysis, were you told who you were going to go ashore with and the plan itself?
Oh, yes, you knew...
What your role was, in effect.
You knew that you were just going to go into the beaches and clear the beaches to help the infantry and to secure the beach. That was the objective. And then C Squadron, one crew of C Squadron had to go up to Pegasus Bridge to assist the 4th Commandos, but there was only two tanks left out of that particular troop. A Squadron, when they came off the beaches, only 5 tanks out of 20 came off the beach. That's 3/4 of the tanks had been lost.
On the beaches?
Yes. But only 5 tanks came off the beach. That's in the regimental history. But by the end of the second day, they were back to 19 tanks again. So the organisation was really fantastic. Some of those 19 were reclaimed tanks that had been drowned in the water, been overrun by the incoming tide, got into the engine. Those tanks would be recovered and used again. So by the end of the second day, that Ace were back up to 19 tanks, which was marvellous.
Were you told what the backing would be from the other units? I'm thinking of artillery and the air and so forth.
No.
We didn't
know what was... All we were concerned with was our infantry. I think it was 189 Brigade. I think. I'm not. I can't swear to what brigade it was with us, but it was the Norfolks and the people that we'd been training with, and the Rifle Brigade and the Suffolks. And then we were with different divisions, because the Middlesex, I think they were with the 43rd Division, but was always with infantry.